to my outstanding family and friends near and far, old and new. This is Kevin Mercurio on the mic, and welcome to the 22nd episode of the Metaphorigens podcast. Now, to show support, if you like this sort of content, please make sure to rate and subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or Google Podcasts or whatever platform you're listening to this on. And follow at Metaphorigens on Instagram, that's at Metaphorigens, where I'll be posting most of my updates as well as on my personal website, kjbmercurio.com/Metaphorigens. Just a reminder, I will hold another draw on my 30th episode for the elegant butterfly printed custom Metaphorigens shirt, so follow the Instagram page to be placed into the draw. Okay, so for today's episode, I'm going to discuss an unusual idiom that I personally encounter very often in the creation of podcast episodes, and academics encounter universally when putting together scientific publications. Let's establish the setting. You recently just moved into a new apartment complex on one of the busiest streets in Toronto. Coming from a small town in northern Ontario, you decided to move there in the hopes of pursuing your dream of becoming a world-renowned novelist. With the great inspiration of art shows, lively performances, and bustling crowds, you acquire the notion that the city's energy would spark a flow of ideas that can be webbed together into the 21st century's Moby Dick. With the last box of remaining belongings in your arms, you press the elevator call button in the downstairs lobby. You catch a glimpse of the bulletin board above the call button and look at the many advertisements for pet sitting, high school tutoring, and car sales, each having those Tier 1 tags with the service provider's contact information. On the top right of the board is a colorful poster with large font and cartoon depictions of books and pencils. It reads, "Block party for local writers right outside the complex, this Friday from 8 p.m. to indefinite. New writers are encouraged to attend." "Wow," you say out loud, "what a great opportunity to meet the local writing community. Hopefully I have a few ideas down that I can bounce off experienced writers at the block party." Upon entry into your new apartment, you immediately make space on your desk and place yourself there with your MacBook Pro. For the next 3 days, you make it your mission to come up with several ideas for your novel that you can share, vaguely of course, while networking at the block party. What genre are you going to claim your throne? You think about thrones, medieval lore, kings and queens, royalty, dragons, gold, knights and dwarves and wizards and magic, enchanted forests, spells. They've all been exhausted beyond capacity. Capacity? Electricity, lightning, flash, power, superpowers, superheroes, villains, morality and justice, law and order, criminal investigations, mysteries, homicides, serial killers, Halloween clowns, comedy and tragedy. Damn it, so unoriginal. Original? Genuine, one of a kind, sympathetic, emotions, feelings, touch, sensing, vision, eyesight, soreness, aching, relaxing, chair, thrones, fuck! On the day of the block party, your best idea is an enchanted chair that gives sitters the capacity of superpowers of heightened sensing to investigate serial killers. Hey, it's original, so you go ahead and pat yourself on the back. It finally reaches 8 p.m. You head down to the elevator and exit the complex. The block party is massive and incredibly lively, blocked off on each end of the street. In the middle of the street, there's a large white tent with enormous speakers on each corner, amplifying loud, uproarious jazz music down all sides. To the left, tables and tables of various hors d'oeuvres and drinks, drinks being alcoholic to extra alcoholic, designated by poster signs of various colors. On the right, stand-up tables for people to network and chat about writing, current events, local or global, and life. You grab a few pigs in a blanket, a term you're ready to discuss, an extra alcoholic red wine, and approach the nearest table of writers. There's an elderly gentleman seemingly dressed in 18th century attire, with a top hat and monocle, next to a short brunette woman in a tiger print dress. Across from them are two other women, one with an absurdly large sun hat and the other with tape across her mouth. "Hello all, can I join?" "Absolutely affirmative," the gentleman says. "We were just contemplating our latest pieces." "Well, three of us were. The other is currently incapable of any verbal communication whatsoever." The woman with the tape across her mouth glares at him. "Awesome," you say. "I was hoping to bounce some novel ideas off experienced writers like yourselves." "Well, do go on," the woman in the tiger dress says. "Tell us of your latest endeavor." "Right. Well, you see, it still needs a bit of work. I was brainstorming off word clouds like we're taught in our writing class, you see, and, well, I came up with this idea, you see, about, throne or chair that gives those who sit on said chair the ability or super ability to vastly improve their senses and, oh, their capacity of critical thinking in order to investigate, well, the mysteries of serial killers. You gulp the lump in the back of your throat. You see, it's like a mystery mixed with fantasy, themes of exploring morality and justice, those sorts of things. After a few seconds of silence, the woman in the enormous sun hat says, "My, my, my." You break the silence again. "So, well, what do you think?" "I think it's bloody brilliant," the 18th century gentleman says. "Just dazzling dichotomy, darling," the woman in the tiger dress says. "I agree, very original," the woman in the sun hat says. The woman with the tape over her mouth noises with a thumbs up. "Wow, really? Thanks so much. I'm glad these past few days of thinking really paid off. I'm going to start writing it now." You rush back to the complex, ride the elevator up to your unit, and plant yourself at your desk. You open up Scrivener and excitedly wait for the words to flow into your fingers. However, there is such loud noise from the writer's block party that it makes it almost impossible to concentrate on your novel. Even closing all the windows doesn't help. You head back down and find the unusual quartet at the same standing table you left them at. "Hi again. Just wondering when this party will end at? Because of this writer's block, I'm finding it difficult to work on my novel."
"Did you just use a preposition at the end of your question?"
the woman in the tiger dress asks.
"Maleficent malarkey,"
the gentleman with the top hat says. "My, my, my," the woman with the giant sun hat says.
"Yuck,"
the woman with the tape across her mouth noises. Finally, your teacher looks up from your writing assignment and says,
"So I gave you an exercise to help encourage a flow of ideas for your novel by writing about yourself and a story about you writing a novel, and in your story about yourself, you end up not writing anything."
"I suppose," you say.
"You know, normally most of my students end their assignments with the first few pages of their novel."
"I know," you say.
"Try again," your teacher says, "and this time create a cast of supporting characters, not non-supporting characters."
Saddened, you take your writing assignment from your teacher's hands and head back to your apartment complex, hoping that it wasn't such a mistake to move to the big city after all.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Which reality are we in?
Jokes aside, this concept of an inability to write plagues many of us, from career writers to academic manuscript authors to those who have to devise government reports. But how did such a quintessential name for this word dam sprout? What's the origin to the expression writer's block? Most of this information was obtained from different articles and writers' opinions about the meaning, origin, and tactics against this idiom. All sources we mention in the description. Writing about writer's block seems like a writing exercise for the prolific writer, the best of the best, like Stephen King or J.K. Rowling, who apparently I'm supposed to hate now. But speaking about what I wrote about writer's block, that's definitely something I can accomplish. We continue a series of an unplanned theme, that being procrastination, with the experience most people have claimed to encounter. The anxiety-induced panic of a blankness within the first page or the end of a collection of pages, the extremely grueling quest for motivation or self-confidence in one's own creativity, the debilitating horror of stiff dexterity followed by the dread of unproductiveness. Like carpal tunnel, we firmly grasp the pencil or pen, form an enclosed claw to slam on keystrokes as soon as they finally come to fruition. Yes, writer's block. The term, the myth. The legend.
If your writing project intentionally killed the creative dog in your brain and stole the car guiding your concentration, it would be its John Wick. But before we get to its origin, let's expand a bit on this concept. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines writer's block as, quote, a psychological inhibition preventing a writer from providing with a piece. However, the agreement of its very existence seems to be controversial amongst writers of all genres. Editor-in-chief Stephanie Flaxman of Copyblogger and author Ray Elliott of The Write Life tend to side in favor of the phenomenon being real, while historian Susan Reynolds believes that writer's block is the unconscious realization of, quote, not being prepared to move on to the next level. And researching writer's block had in itself some challenges. Let's agree that writer's block does exist, whether that be a truly psychological hindrance or whether it's some other entity entirely. Article after article from magnanimous novelists, bloggers, and writing coaches offer the state-of-the-art tips and tricks to get you, a potential writer, often in their beginner stages, out of your word void. Academic institutes like Purdue University and the Founding College of the University of Toronto dedicate website space to address the concern about writer's block experienced by their students. Quote, the 9 tips on how to totally crush writer's block by Brian Hutchison on Positive Writer, or my favorite article titled, quote, Writer's Block, 30 Ways to Roundhouse Kick It in the Face by Henneke Duistermat of Smart Blogger. Yes, even podcasts solely dedicated to writing have debated on it, like writing coach Dave Ursillo's podcast, Written Spoken, although he ruined the episode ending with basically an advertisement to his courses. I'll summarize everything these writing experts suggested. 1, get rid of distractions. 2, try tinkering the process of how you write. 3, try doing anything else in the meantime. And 4, ask yourself, why the hell are you even writing to begin with? I promise you, by focusing on these 4 points, especially the latter question, will have you either writing in no time or have you doing something much better suited to your interests. The problem doesn't lie in whether it exists or not. Some common experience like writer's block has been lived by thousands of writers from beginner to legendary level. The problem also doesn't seem to be in the techniques to lift that barrier impeding one from writing the next great novel. The problem in writer's block seems to be how writers describe and cope with it. The most interesting information to me of this topic were quotes from writers that have experienced writer's block. Before the term was coined, and yes, we'll get to that origin, don't you fret, famous 19th century English poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge described it as, quote, an indefinite, indescribable terror, to which he continued lamenting in a record of his notebook, quote, so completely has a whole year passed with scarcely the fruits of a month. Oh, sorrow and shame, I have done nothing. He lived the rest of his life after publishing his most famous work in his mid-20s, succumbing to opium addiction. Sadly, this isn't the only victim to what historian Lawrence Samuel says is, quote, the cruelest thing about writer's block. Tom Dardis, in his 1989 book, The Thirsty Muse, Alcohol and the American Writer, notes the following 5 winners of the Nobel Prize in Literature being American authors we deem as legendary level in modern day, but were also alcoholics. Sinclair Lewis, the author of Aerosmith, Eugene O'Neill, the screenwriter of Long Day's Journey into Night, William Faulkner, the author of The Sound and the Fury, Ernest Hemingway, the author of a plethora of novels like The Old Man and the Sea, and John Steinbeck, the author of The Grapes of Wrath. And this list doesn't scratch the surface of other successful writers who also attribute alcohol to their writing process, like Thomas Wolfe, Tennessee Williams, and Truman Capote. And these examples pale in comparison to the archetype of writer's block and the quintessential representative of imaginable success from an early age, F. Scott Fitzgerald. Described in an amazing 2004 article on writer's block by The New Yorker, quote, the artistic flameout was, quote, famous at 23, washed up at 40, and dead by a heart attack at 44. In his own words, Fitzgerald famously said, quote, there is no second acts in American lives. In 1947, editor of the Partisan Review, William Barrett, claims that, quote, the modern writer was by definition an estranged neurotic, because the difficulty of being authentic in a false-face world forced him to go deeper and deeper into the unconscious, thus pushing him toward madness. The game is to go as close as possible without crossing over. Fitzgerald was our generation's Macaulay Culkin. There are so many stories, amazing stories, about great writers who are known for their long break periods between pieces, like Fran Lebowitz and Harper Lee, or one-hit wonders like Moby Dick author Herman Melville. But perhaps this escapes the crux of this podcast, which is to talk about the origin of terms and expressions. We find ourselves there now, as writer's block is a term coined by American psychoanalyst Edmund Bergler in the 1940s. Its cause, he claimed, paraphrased by the New Yorker article, quote, oral masochism, entrapment in rage over the milk-denying pre-Oedipal mother. Starved before, the writer chose to become starved again. That is, blocked. It is with this knowledge that Bergler is known to have treated 40 writers dealing with writer's block with a 100% success rate. As a final say towards the end of his work, he states, quote, the megalomaniac pleasure of creation produces a type of elation which cannot be compared with that experienced by other mortals. So where do we go from here? Is it a choice to be inhibited in the art of storytelling? From personal experience through what I believe to be writer's block over my own long story Oblivion might have simply been a matter of prioritization, what I had to do at the time versus what I wanted to do at the time. Sure, I wanted to write, but how could plots reveal themselves to a mind clouded by other tasks? So therefore, despite my hesitation to agree with Bergler's theory of, quote, entrapment and rage over the milk-denying pre-Oedipal mother, choice does seem to play a major factor. But what do you think? Could calm awareness and prioritization fix your writer's block or general creative hindrance? I end this segment with one final quote, one final writer's experience, or rather inexperience, with the topic at hand. In the keynote address of the 6th Annual Writer Symposium by the Sea, author of Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury states, quote, I've never worked a day in my life. I've never worked a day in my life. The joy of writing has propelled me from day to day and year to year. I want you to envy me, my joy. Get out here and say tonight, am I being joyful? And if you've got a writer's block, you can cure it this evening by stopping whatever you're writing and doing something else. You picked the wrong subject. Perhaps you're right, Bradbury, but perhaps you meant wrong platform. I hope this podcast proves him wrong. Before we get to the next segment, do you love listening to podcasts? If you're like myself, you may have contemplated even starting a podcast yourself. Let me tell you, as one of the many ways one can creatively express themselves, starting this podcast was one of the best decisions I have ever made. For one thing, it sort of gives you an excuse to learn about things you actually are interested in and understand it by speaking to an audience about it. For another, it has given me the opportunity to meet other podcasters and other science communicators who inspire me in their own creative endeavors. The problem in starting something new is that it may be difficult to know where to start. That's where Buzzsprout comes in. Buzzsprout is a seamless service that helps one launch a professional podcast with over 100,000 people supported on their platform. Your show can be online and listed in all the major podcast directories, like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more, within minutes of finishing your recording. Additionally, you get a sweet-looking podcast website, detailed analytics to support the growth of your show, by far the greatest feature, methods of promoting and marketing your show, the list goes on. And of course, the Buzzsprout community of experts and podcast hosts offers great tips via online forums, YouTube videos, and even quick podcast episodes themselves. To start your own podcast and get a $20 Amazon gift card you can use towards simple podcast equipment you may need, click the affiliate link in the episode's description. This lets Buzzsprout know that I sent you to their service and will help support Metaforagens in money towards creating more butterfly merch. Buzzsprout, the easiest way to start a podcast. And now, back to the episode. For my communication segment, I would like to talk about something that I've just recently heard about and that may be of interest to the average Metaphorigens listener. Actually, the core concept behind it can be expanded to include multiple genres. That topic is academic ghostwriting. Now, ghostwriting has been around for a long time. I actually first heard about it in the music industry. Many top artists have been supported by other artists who wrote some songs for them,
Ariana Grande had Harry Styles, Beyonce had Sia, Elton John had Bernie Taupin, even Elvis Presley had Jerry Leiber. In these cases, ghostwriters are often ecstatic to offer their services to friends or even their idols. Let's define it first so we're on the same page. Most definitions are in the context of producing a large body of written work. Masterclass, an online educational platform that hosts a magnificent array of the most successful people in specific lines of work, defines ghostwriting as, quote, when another writer takes on the book writing responsibility of an author or client. Many times this is done when a person cannot or does not want to write their own book, but has a strong idea for one. Most of the time, ghostwriters will write in the voice of the idea originator and mildly include the client in outlining the work and reviewing final drafts. Now, this is different from co-writing or co-authoring, which is when a writer and idea originator actively collaborate together to complete the piece. For example, for a novel, perhaps you would be in charge of the introductory chapters, while your partner could take over setting up the conflict in subsequent chapters. But academic ghostwriting is a whole other monster. For this, I turn to the story of Ed Dante, a pseudonym for the real-life academic ghostwriter Dave Tomar. Back in 2010, scarily already 11 years ago, the Chronicle for Higher Education published an essay about a, quote, student paper mill, a business of completing college or university students' writing assignments. This, already somewhat surprising, is minuscule compared to the confirmed jobs Tomar was tasked to do over the decade of his career as an academic ghostwriter. In addition to simple written assignments, Tomar states, quote, I've written toward a master's degree in cognitive psychology, a PhD in sociology, and a handful of postgraduate credits in international diplomacy. I've worked on bachelor's degrees in hospitality, business administration, and accounting. I've written for courses in history, cinema, labor relations, pharmacology, theology, sports management, maritime security, airline services, sustainability, municipal budgeting, marketing, philosophy, ethics, Eastern religion, postmodern architecture, anthropology, literature, and public administration. I've attended 36 online universities. I've completed 12 graduate theses of 50 pages or more, all for someone else. In his essay, Tomar has made a salary upwards of $66,000 in 1 year. That's double the annual median personal income given by the U.S. Census Bureau for 2019. Those who seeked out his services were of three demographics, quote, English as a second language student, the hopelessly deficient student, and the lazy rich kid. Despite being unable to rationalize the unethical behavior of how he made a living, he explains his reasoning in a follow-up interview by the Chronicle, quote, we are so deeply entrenched for a lot of economic reasons in this cost structure where colleges have inflated their costs so dramatically, but the return on it is completely static. Tomar wrote a book about his decade of helping America's college youth cheat, titled The Shadow Scholar. The craziness about academic ghostwriting is that it's not old news, and it's not breaking any laws or academic rules. Yes, there is the obvious, very serious offense of plagiarism, which the University of Oxford defines as, quote, presenting someone else's work or ideas as your own, with or without their consent, by incorporating it into your work without full acknowledgement. Think about that. What academic ghostwriters do are completely original work, no copy-paste shenanigans occurring. Sure, clients are presenting someone else's work or ideas as their own with the consent of the ghostwriter, but what are clients incorporating it into? That piece of work did not exist prior to them handing it in at the end of the semester. And it's not exactly hard to find these student paper mills either. Tomar originally started as a freelancer before joining an online company, and these online companies are freely marketed, Academic Ghostwriter and Acadwrite being the most prominent companies. It's in demand. Another freelance academic ghostwriter under the pseudonym Ghost Wizard posted an article on Medium describing the effort of said lifestyle. Quote, the time it takes for Spirituality and Health or National Geographic to return my query letter about an article idea, if they ever do, I can get a minimum 10 to 15 customers willing to pay me at least $120 each to write their papers for them. That's enough to keep the heat on for a few months, make a car payment, buy enough kombucha and avocados to satiate my needs, support my LA Fitness, Hulu, and Spotify memberships, and take care of my ever more hungry cat needs.
Ghost Wizard also mentions, quote, one writer, according to Juwan Park at QZ.com, charges $5,000 for a 50-page graduate thesis and $12,000 for a 100-page doctorate dissertation. One customer at $12,000 is enough to make an individual's half a year fairly comfortable, depending on their bills and debts. The article's title, The Shady Business of Academic Ghostwriting, is truly an understatement. It's the American freaking gold rush leading to the delivery of undeserved degrees. Now we go even deeper than that. The outraged unfairness of some rich folks getting qualifications that required even less effort from them than from me writing about them is bad. But what if lives were at stake? We move on to more sinister roles of academic ghostwriting, to the field I find myself entrenched in now, biomedical sciences. Dr. Barbara Sherwin, a McGill University psychology professor, was tied into a class action lawsuit of which over 8,000 women sued the drug company Wyeth, now owned by Pfizer. Yes, you may have heard this company's name recently. You see, Dr. Sherwin was the primary author of a review about pharmacological treatment options for age-associated memory loss. However, this review was written by an employee of a paper mill called DesignRight, hired by Wyeth to attract the involvement of leading scientists in their field of hormone replacement therapy, or HRT, and this therapy was part of the review. As described by a McLean's article about the lawsuit, quote, lawyers representing the women who claimed they were harmed by their hormone replacement therapy, or HRT drugs, discovered that scientific research papers extolling the virtues of the treatment while downplaying potential harm appeared to have been written, not by the academics who signed their name to the papers, but by writers hired by the pharmaceutical company. And that's not new, as, quote, blockbuster drugs like Merck's painkiller Vioxx pulled from the market in 2004 after it was linked to heart problems, and the antidepressants Paxil and Zoloft continued to come under scrutiny for citing ghostwritten articles that promote their use. Similarly, in 2004, it was found that the manufacturer of Pfizer's Neurontin used a ghostwriting campaign to market off-label uses. More information on these drugs and the conclusion of the class action lawsuit can be found in the description. Society has been at an unusual crossroads of trusting Big Pharma to invent medicines while also helplessly unaware of their insincerity. In a 2010 article by Science Mag, a prominent scientific journal, quote, it came to light that Merck had paid the publishing company Elsevier to produce a journal, Australasian Journal of Bone and Joint Medicine, which looked like a peer-reviewed medical journal, but was filled with articles and reviews from medical education companies, including articles favorable to Merck's products for osteoporosis. How insane is it that private companies can create scientific journals to publish studies that favor their drugs? I will mention that these specific articles gaffing at academic ghostwriting in the pharmaceutical industry are from one or two decades ago, so perhaps things are changing. In fact, even then, reputable scientific journals took notice and revised their standards. From the Science Mag article, quote, the Journal of the American Medical Association, PLOS Medicine, the British Medical Journal, and the Journal of General Internal Medicine have developed stringent authorship guidelines to ascertain the contributions of each author and obtain full disclosure of authors' funding sources and financial ties. However, ghostwriting doesn't stop there. In a 2019 article published in Nature, another prominent journal, even peer review is subject to the shadiness of academic ghostwriting. Quote, a large proportion of graduate students and postdocs ghostwrite peer reviews for senior colleagues and supervisors, receiving no professional credit for their work. Based on a study surveying 498 early career researchers in the US, Europe, and Asia. Those who had listened to episode 15 of this podcast know how important the peer review process is in reviewing any academic work. Should we be outraged that elite scientists are passing on this responsibility to early researchers while receiving all the credit, like undergraduates receiving degrees through their ghostwritten work? The answer should be a resounding yes, but the problem is devising methods of detecting this practice while also making it undesirable other than its obvious hint of immorality. Throughout my academic career, I have always understood the importance of crediting someone for the work they've accomplished. Now, I understand the equal importance of pointing out the work that someone has not done. You see, as unlike the ghostwriters and the music industry's wish to support mentors in their craft,
academia in all its extravagant, elitist, exclusionary culture, and awkward allocation of funding projects based on quantitative metrics like number of publications, has early career academics just wishing to be heard at all. For today's episode, I'll be interviewing someone I believe is not only doing great research, but also engaged in writing articles related to science on popular news sites. She is a PhD student in biochemistry at the University of Ottawa. Outside of the lab, her time is spent as a freelance science writer and communicator. She is passionate about spreading her love of science and inspiring the next generation of scientists. Please welcome the outrageously talented Sarah Laframboise.
Cool. So again, thank you for doing this. I know you have like a lot to do, and I really appreciate that you took the time out of your day to talk to me.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. I'm like super honored that you had me, Kev.
Yeah, and it came from just a simple conversation, which I will talk about in a bit, but just so we can start for the listeners. Again, I've known Sarah for at least over 2 years now. So I think 2018 is when we first met. Like you started in the same lab that I just finished at, and you came in and you did a presentation about something about sushi proteins, which I found really interesting.
Sushi cells.
Sorry, that's why I vouched for you. So I introduced you before this segment, but just to reiterate, you are a graduate student at the University of Ottawa, in fact, did medicine there, and recently transferred to the PhD route, so congratulations on that. You're a student in the Bates Lab, which focuses on yeast research, yeast genetics, and honestly, your resume is stellar. It's filled with a lot, which obviously you can talk about what you want to address, but you're on the editorial committee for the University of Ottawa's Journal of Medicine, as well as the Canadian Science Policy Center, and you also founded a nonprofit and also volunteer time in many other organizations. So it's truly inspiring. Maybe you can just to the listeners, speak about your experience in mm-hmm. science, you know, your PhD project, and maybe projects you've done before, and sort of the extracurriculars in science you're involved in.
Yeah, for sure. First of all, thank you for saying that, because I don't know. I don't really see it that way, but I mean, I guess so. I mostly just feel crazy a lot of the time, because I like to be involved in a lot of things, and I have always been that way. So to me, it just feels normal. Yeah, specifically with like science communication stuff, I guess I really got started into it during my undergrad. I guess it was like my first or second year, I started writing for a company called QuantumRun.com. And it was, again, all volunteer stuff. And you wrote an article every, like, couple months. And it was really, like, my first article was, like, preserving the brains of brain-dead people. And, like, just, like, super, like, clickbaity. And I, like, didn't really know much about the field at that point. And I was, like, an undergrad. So I was just, like, writing to write at that point. Yeah, so I wrote that for them for, like, 3 years, actually. So I have a lot of articles with them. It was such a good experience because I could write about anything that I wanted. It really like got me into this kind of like outside of the classroom, outside of the lab, thinking of science. And yeah, and I guess once I moved to Ottawa, I started writing with Massive Science, who is an amazing platform, which trains and pays scientists to write, which is awesome, because that's a big thing in this field, is actually getting paid for what you do, which is really important for grad students especially too, right? Right. You need to get some money on the side. You can't just do everything for free. So yeah, they're a really great organization. And then I started writing for the Health Science Inquiry as well. So I've done like one piece for them already, and then doing another one for this upcoming issue. That's pretty much the like my SciComm journey. And then like I guess recently I've kind of gotten more into like the publication side of things with like the Ottawa Journal of Medicine. So I've been producing their journals for like just over 2 years. So I've done about 5 issues, I guess, now, which is lots of fun because then that's more like the graphic side of everything.
Yeah, no, I think that's again. Honestly, so much. It sounds like you have not a lot of free time. You can also think about that when you have free time, this is what you do.
Yeah.
Science communicators do. They write. They speak about it in public.
Yeah, and I think the important thing is like with your podcast too, like you do it because you love it. You don't do it just because it's like a subset of science things that you do on the outside. Like I think like sometimes I find that I love this stuff even like more than the lab. So I think it's more of just like finding like the reason why you got into science. And like for me it is this kind of like basis of love of science in general. So yeah. Keep me sane.
And in terms of the lab, maybe you can just maybe just speak quickly about your PhD work.
Yeah, so I just transferred into my PhD about a year ago. Yeah, the same lab as Kevin, so yeast stuff as well. But I do a lot of work with a yeast lysine cell transferase called NuA4. And basically, we're trying to figure out how NuA4 plays a role in regulating different parts of the compositions of the cell, in particular different organelles within the cell and how these organelles are actually like made and composed. So we're looking at how NuA4 and acetylation that comes from that and how that's affecting the different organelle structures. Kristen, every time I do like a pitch like that, I'm always like, was that a good pitch? I don't know.
And just to take it or relate it back to the previous segment before this interview. So I talked a lot about academic ghostwriting. And really, this whole episode came from a simple conversation I had with Sarah that involved, you know, what she does writing-wise in terms of writing articles about science. We spoke about ghostwriting. So basically, I talked about this earlier, but you're kind of taking the responsibility of writing for somebody else who had a specific topic or idea in mind. You're kind of giving them the credit for it and producing the majority of the content within the article. So I kind of termed this academic ghostwriting. I didn't really know that academic ghostwriting actually existed. There's actually a crazy amount of information about academic ghostwriting, which is truly bizarre. It's kind of an in-demand field for people that are maybe not interested in academia, but are just good at writing in general. This leads to a lot of problems within undergraduate studies and even graduate studies. There was a story that I talked about in the segment, an academic ghostwriter. His name is Dave Tamar, and he basically confessed to writing dissertations, essays, attended tens of online universities for people, and he was paid for this work. Incredibly bizarre, the amount of crazy stuff that academic ghostwriting encompasses. Really, the whole jungle of academia, it doesn't seem that there's a way or some sort of policy that can catch academic ghostwriting like plagiarism. Plagiarism, we know, is a big problem in academia. There are at least software or smart professors who review the work and can identify plagiarism. My question to you, based on your experience in academia, were you surprised that people can get high-level degrees by paying other people to write their projects? And if you know of ways of catching this sort of practice?
First of all, I'm definitely not surprised at all. I think academia just like creates this environment. There's no way to catch it. And the reason why I say that is because even like most undergraduate classes and even graduate classes to an extent are like TA'd by other grad students or undergrads, like higher level undergrads. And you're expecting mostly those TAs to actually catch all of these mistakes. It's not so much even the professors that are actually teaching the classes. I don't know. I've been a TA for a course and even like reading like hundreds of essays, and then you don't know any of these people, right? And so like even the plagiarism you can catch to a certain extent, but like ghostwriting, like the only way you could figure it out is if you learn that person's voice. And there's just no way in the way that academia is set up that you would ever be able to like actually learn someone's voice just based off of like one class. So I don't think that it's ever really going to be able to be caught. I know you mentioned like mandatory defenses and such like that. I think like that's really great for like the higher level degrees, for like masters and PhDs. I don't know if it's like feasible for an undergrad, probably not. But again, like I think it just kind of shows this sort of like academic culture where like you're expected to read and write papers and do exams, and that's the only metric of of smartness that they have. So yeah. I think it's like it's crazy because outside of academia, like the world definitely recognizes other like strengths and other like ways that people think and can like deliver their knowledge. Academia is just so far behind in that, like if you can write an essay and like get an A+, then you get an A+ in the class. It's just so like cut and dry that way. I think like in the current way it's set up, there's definitely like no way that you could get around it.
Yeah, I almost find that the evaluation of how successful you are in a course is so determined on how well you do written work. And I think the way that's structured makes it so difficult to catch these things. And that's why I did mention. So before I gave to Sarah some suggestions on how this could be caught. And that's why I said some sort of defense. Because I know in undergrad at the University of Ottawa and in certain programs, you do have to present something at the end of at least the last year of your program. You could be doing an honors project, like working in a lab and then presenting that work to your peers and a couple of professors, for example. And obviously this is some sort of way to show that you actually know what you're talking about. But currently the structure is just these exams, like you mentioned, and essay writing for maybe social sciences or other fields. So perhaps the structure needs to change.
Yeah, it's even crazy if you think like even for an honors project, I think sciences are a bit different because it does have to be more hands-on. Like you're in the lab doing something and then you have to like give a presentation on things that you've actually done. But in like social sciences or other programs, it's definitely still that like written basis of delivering your like final project. I think sciences and like maybe like engineering or like things that are a bit more hands-on, maybe like have more opportunities to kind of extend into those non-written forms, but other things it's much more difficult for sure.
And there can't be really software like that. I know in plagiarism, like I got curious because I never really looked at, they talk about how easy it is to catch plagiarism now when you're an undergrad, and I never really looked into how they actually do it. And most of the time they can probably catch it because a lot of professors are reading hundreds of papers in their field, so they'll know if you're plagiarizing something along published scientific literature. But there is crazy software out there that can pinpoint you plagiarizing content off the internet.
Yeah, I was gonna say we use Turnitin in my undergrad a lot, and I used to like get so scared submitting papers because even like especially for science lab reports we used to have to put through them. But it picks up on like every other lab report that's ever been submitted for that class. It's in that database. So what happens is you end up submitting it and it's the exact same for so much of it. So it gets scary because your result line, that's like a set lab report, we all got the same result for it.
Yeah.
And it's the exact same. So you'd submit it and it'd be like 30% identical. Yeah, it gets scary.
Yes, I've never actually used different softwares, but when I was an undergrad, we never really had to input in a certain software like that. Do you have to like actually type it in, or you send pic, because it's mostly written in a lab notebook, isn't it?
It's whenever you are like submitting like a lab report or an essay or stuff like that, you would submit the full like document to Turnitin, and then that's where your PI or your professors would actually like pull the piece off of to grade you.
Yeah,
so it's like a submission service, I guess, but it like does this like plagiarism scan before getting it to the professors. But it's scary accurate to the point where it can almost pick up many of my citations.
Yeah, they really, I just quickly went on their website just before this discussion, and they promote what they call fingerprinting, which I find really interesting. They basically imprint a fingerprint almost on whatever you're submitting, and they search this fingerprint in the database. The way the fingerprint matching works is proprietary IP, so they can't really tell you how that works. I don't know, it seems a little bit fishy. Almost
yeah,
like
no,
facial
definitely.
Recognition software.
It's like as simple as like not translating a sentence into something that's like unique enough that it's separate from what you read it from. So like it gets really hard sometimes, right? Put it completely into your own words, especially if it's a fact or something.
Like we've been at the University of Ottawa for quite some time now. Do you think our institute is providing resources to train graduate students to write and communicate effectively?
I think to some extent, yes. But I think this is one thing that you can just always be better at. Yeah, I don't think you could ever do enough of this kind of stuff. Personally, I blame more of my undergraduate training not setting me up properly. The grad program that we're in now, like in the Faculty of Medicine, I think they do have like some really great resources, like the SciComm course that we both took. I think like you learn a lot of things, but it's very like self-motivated. Like if you want to be better at it, there's the resources there to do it. But I think that creating that like foundation in like each scientist is definitely not there. I think if that was to happen, it would have to be some sort of like mandatory like training. And I honestly think it should be in your undergrad where you have to take like a science communications course or like a science writing course if you are in your undergrad. I had a professor in my third and fourth year, Dr. Jan Sapp at York University, and he was actually a like science writer. So he actually wrote like books, and he was a trained geneticist, but he wrote books and was like really engaged in that community as well. And I didn't even think about like that scientist like needed to write until I took his course. And like literally the first thing he said was, all of you are like scientists and you cannot write. You all will write the worst things. And he's like, I'm not going to read it. So if you're going to submit something that's bad, just leave my class right now.
Oh my.
But it was because of him that like, I was like, oh, okay. Like, this is cool. Like, you know, I mean, at that time, like I was writing on the side and I was like, oh, I am a scientist. I guess I'm like kind of in this niche area where like I am a scientist, but I also can write. So like, that's pretty cool. But yeah, it's definitely not like in the foundation of a biology undergrad or like a biochem undergrad or a biomed. I think like that's kind of where it has to start, getting those things into your brain like early on, and like, you know, bio 101, like you should also learn how to write.
Yeah, you're learning a lot about memorizing obviously scientific facts, but communicating those is like a skill on its own that you have to develop. You mentioned the science communication course we took, and I agree that's a good course, but you don't learn about writing in that course.
Yeah, no, for sure.
You learn a lot about speaking about science in a sort of to a public, more general audience, which I found really nice. But writing is for sure something that, even when I was an undergrad at U Ottawa, I can't recall any sort of resource that they offered.
No, yeah. And like you're kind of forced into those lab courses and just like writing lab reports. And you've never written from a science like language before. And writing in science languages like math are literally, there's like X, Y, and Z that needs to be there, and you just have to like fill it in. And I think it's a art form. Like you literally have to be like so nitpicky on the details, and it's like writing without empathy and like attached writing as well. So it definitely is like a specific skill set.
Do you feel that the program you're currently in, you know, your supervisor and the peers that you are currently around, do you feel that they're at least helping you in that regard?
I think so, yeah. I think we're probably a bit lucky with our lab, Kristen being like a big proponent of SciComm. Yeah. She's taught the courses, and I don't know, I'm sure you can attest to this as well, but like presenting in our lab I find has been big. Yeah, it's really tough. It's also like super good because you're kind of ripped apart, but you learn really fast what to do and what not to do. And even like watching and seeing the people around you is definitely like the easiest and probably the only way that we can really learn at the grad level, like how to do these kind of things, is just seeing someone do something and then be like, oh, like that looked really good. Like I want to do my presentation like that, or like, or that paper sounded really good. I'm going to try and like write in this tone that they did, or like, that's more the way of learning at our level, I guess.
Yeah, learning from people with experience. Yeah. I'll definitely attest to that. I would say that I was a terrible communicator of science when I started in Dr. Bates's lab, Kristen's lab. I remember I would see another PhD student in the lab, Elizabeth. She was from the get-go, she was a great communicator. And I remember when I presented my first lab meeting, it's just awful, like torn to shreds, on the verge of tears, terrible. But you kind of need that to allow you to develop into a communicator that I would think that both of us are now, that we're really good at now.
Yeah, and I do think it does have a lot to do with our environment as well.
So yeah, we did talk about what U Ottawa could implement. I shouldn't say that U Ottawa doesn't implement anything. I know that they have these altitude workshops, So maybe if there are you Ottawa grad students listening to this, they do provide these workshops called Altitude. I haven't been to them, but I would hope that they promote these more. I'm not sure the success rate on it, but there is writing workshops, thesis writing workshops, time management workshops.
And GSAT also has some as well. Like there's like a floor where you can just go and write. And I think they have some like resources there as well. The resources are definitely there if you want to find them. You just have to want to find them.
Yes. We talked a little bit about your extensive resume, and I am hyping it up a lot. Because I think you should hype it up a lot. But you are involved in a lot of scientific writing, and being a PhD student, you will be doing scientific article writing, which is different than mainstream science writing. So we'll have to distinguish those two different ways of writing. I'll ask, and you might have actually mentioned this earlier, but what got you interested in writing?
I think a big thing for me was that I come from a very like blue collar working family. None of my family has really like gone to university or like studied science at all. So it's definitely like a new thing, me going into it and not really having any way to like communicate to my family what I was doing and what I was interested in. And so I think that like that first or second year when I started writing for Quantum Run, I really kind of got into this like, if I write an article about something cool, then my family like reaches out to me like, oh, Sarah, that article you wrote was so cool. Like, tell me more about this and this. And I think like it definitely started for me as a way for me to bridge that gap between like my family and friends who maybe weren't so like science savvy. And I think I really enjoy like people getting hyped about science. I find that really cool. Like you can't do that by just talking like complete gibberish to them. So there's definitely like that translation has to occur. And
no, I agree, especially people who aren't in the science space. When I talk about my research, I feel like they don't really know what I do. My family, I mean, and some of my friends even. The excitement of different techniques that we use, techniques that are even relevant now, like PCR testing for determining if you have COVID or not. Not a really complex technique, but complex to somebody who's not in science. You know, you can tell them that you do PCR.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's like humanizing it.
The rest of your project. Yeah, so back to this distinguishing between mainstream science writing for, say, Massive Science or Quantum Run and scientific article writing in like scientific journals like Nature or Science. What can you say about the differences between the two types of writing?
The biggest difference, to me at least, is that, I think I said this before, but like science articles for like Nature or like at a science level are very mathematic in nature. So like there's like the different subsections, like your intro, your method, your discussion, your conclusion. And it's very much just like filling in the blanks of information that you need. And it's not so much fluffy or flary. It's kind of just to the point. I don't want to say dry because that sounds bad, but it's cut and dry. Like there's no fluff. Use as less words as possible. Like it's very concise, as opposed to like mainstream science articles are definitely like more emotional in nature. Emotion sells. It's one thing I've been learning a lot lately is adding like a personal story to a science story is like the number one thing you could possibly do to connect with people about science. And then like adding like flair and so the storytelling and personality into it, like that's definitely more the mainstream side of science writing. And it allows you just kind of like, have more of your own personal like experience and personality in it. I think that's like a good distinguish between the two.
So when you write for, say, Quantum Run or Massive Science, do you always incorporate some sort of personal aspect into it?
It's hard for those. Most of the time, like, you're not allowed to write from a personal standpoint. But you can add like other people's stories into it too. I think like just the idea of creating a story out of it, and it doesn't have to be like Kevin did this. The main object of your story can be the finding. You just have to tell that story as well. Tell a little bit about like how we got here and how did they come to find this, and like what's the background about it. It's like putting these science pieces in as like the main part of their own story.
And I'm curious about, as somebody who's like, I've only written for Health Science Inquiry as well, but that was just a creative short story of mine. I'm curious about how you reach out to these platforms when you have an idea. Do they come out with some sort of genre in which you're like, okay, I've read something about this, so I'm going to write about that? Or do you already have an idea and then reach out to them seeing if they're interested?
I'd say it's a combination of both. And I've done both. Sometimes you'll see like a call for a pitch So they'll be like, hey, we want to write about one that I wrote was the yeast being able to produce cannabinoids, the same ingredients as marijuana and producing cannabinoids and THC and yeast. They would come out and be like, oh, we want more stories about yeast and biofuels and this kind of sector. And then you could like propose what you think would be a good article in that field. That's something that Massive Science does a lot. They do theme months every so often, and they'll pull from articles that they already have, but they also will put out a call for like certain pieces like that. Yeah, other things, if I come across something in like my everyday life, I'm not just like reading the news, or like I see something on Twitter, and I'll save it and just like see if I can write like a few sentences about it. And if I can write like a little bit more than a few sentences, then I know that I could like translate that into a piece of some sort. So then I would pitch it like a news headline or something that like grabs your attention, and just expanding on it more.
No, that's really cool. And for the majority of these platforms, would you say that you are like a regular person, a regular worker for them, in a sense that they reach out to you when they want something? Or is this something that anybody can, like, how would somebody get involved in writing for these organizations?
Massive Science, I think, is the best example of this. They've created this platform where you can openly pitch and openly say whatever you want, and they will give you critique. So even if they don't think that your piece will translate into a perfect piece for their website, they will like help you modify the pitch, and like they really are focused on like trying to find that story and how you can tell it. And a lot of scientists like kind of fall into the like, here's the finding, that's the whole story. They're like, oh no, like, where did it start? Like, let's take two steps back here, like, explain to me this. So it's very informative and very back and forth, which I really like. Yeah, so that would be like a really great place to start. And when you go into more of the journal side of things, like with Health Science Inquiry and that kind of stuff, that stuff you sign up for more of like a 1 year, like I write one piece a year for them. And I know it happens every like February. And for those, I like more propose my idea and like what I think would fit well into the issue. And I'm particularly a features writer for them, so it has to be something that's like very newsworthy and of interest to people. Yeah, so like I'm writing an article right now about how social media platforms are regulating misinformation during the pandemic, the role that social media has been playing, because like this is the first time in history that we've ever seen social media platforms, for example, stop a president of a country from saying something. So they're showing that they have more power than they say they do. So that was something that I was just like super interested in throughout the pandemic. So I've kind of like translated that into creating a piece on.
Very cool. Very cool. We're going to have similar things. Well, I'm writing about social media and cancel culture.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But awesome. In sort of like a creative short story thing.
Yeah. You'll have like the freaky real version of it. And of the facts.
yeah, exactly. One last thing about your writing. So even myself, I have a specific setup or process of writing in which I need to do certain things in order to get into the groove of writing. So I'll say mine after you, but
okay.
Like what is your writing process, and how do you get in the groove of writing when you start something?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I feel like I'm a bit weird in this sense, because I either...
Oh, we're all weird.
I'm either like completely not able to write. I could sit down and write a whole piece in one sitting. I have like zero in between. So, I mean, at least I know that now, because if I sit down and I like can't write a sentence, then I'm like, okay, Sarah, take a step back. Let's take a break. And I definitely have learned to not force it. And it's tough with deadlines, obviously, because sometimes you have to force it and it gets frustrating. But I think my like counterbalance of that is just to be like super proactive about things, and I'll think about writing a piece like 3 weeks before it's due, just because I know that I'm not able to write it until I'm like in the mood to write it. Yeah, in terms of like a specific like spot, I'm not really too specific on that. I think I just more am like, if I get into the zone, like nothing else matters. I'll sit and write for hours and just get it done in one sitting. I would say like pretty much every single piece I've ever written was done in one sitting, which I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I've always been that way though, even with my undergrad writings and everything. Just
do you just write like your own desk or a coffee shop? What would you prefer?
I need things going on around me, probably because I have four younger brothers and I grew up with sound. Okay. I honestly write with the TV on. It's probably How I Met Your Mother, because I know everything that happened. So it just like, it just sits there in the background and makes noise.
That's fine.
Yeah, definitely just needs to be loud. Usually just at my desk. I would go to a coffee shop if I could. I do like that kind of situation as well, just because it is loud as well. How about you, Kev?
So I need dead silence.
Oh, okay.
I need dead silence, and I need to be, I would say, just at like a familiar desk of mine. So normally like at home somewhere, I prefer to write. I have written one short story in our one of our student offices back at the university, but normally it has to be at like at home, dead silence, nothing else is happening. I'm glad you said what you said about either writing nothing or writing everything. I am exactly the same as you.
Okay.
all my short stories are usually done in one go, and even my podcast episodes, I have to write everything all at once, or else like I'll probably forget my train of thought. For a short story, I've written for 6 hours in one go. Yeah, I find that it's just like, and once you get it done, you just feel so good at the end. Yeah, and I usually need lots of coffee, which is why I have some right now. And my potato chip bowl, I need chips. I don't know why.
Oh, okay.
I need regular chips in this potato chip bowl.
What about greasy fingers?
Yeah, that's a problem.
Oh my god.
That sounds like a nightmare. Yeah,
I'm way too OCD for that.
greasy keyboard buttons and some crumbs, but it gets the job done.
I'm a bit traumatized because I was eating something around my computer and my E is sticking now. So whenever I write, I have like 3 E's in every single thing that I write, and it's like the worst.
Oh no! And it happens so often then.
Yeah, it's bad.
It's a popular letter. So. Plagiarism, we talked about that. Scooping is also something that happens in academia. It's one of the other bad things that happens, where a lot of the times researchers are working on the same thing. Not exactly the same thing, but similarly related. And let's say Sarah goes to a conference, talks about new A4, acetyl transferase. She presents some work about nuclear flares, for example. And somebody's like, oh, that's kind of similar to what I do. I'm just going to look at what she's doing and maybe copy it. And kind of get results based on the work that you're doing. So there's scooping. We talked about academic ghostwriting. These are kind of more unethical things that happen in the academic community, and it's what makes it kind of toxic. My question to you is, in contrast, what's your favorite thing about academia? Something that's nice about the academic community?
I had such a hard time thinking about this answer. A lot more than I should have. I think says. That toxic communities exist and are real. I honestly don't know, Kev.
Oh no.
Okay. Try and think of something constructive. Okay. Academia, you do make like a lot of international connections, and like from places that you maybe wouldn't think that you would be connected. Like when you go to a conference, and conferences in general are super cool, and getting to like meet new people outside of like your lab and your institution. I think that part of it's really cool. I think like a lot of my personal problems with academia, it's an institutional thing, and I think it's probably the same at all institutions, but it's just overall kind of way that everything's set up. It's hard for it not to be toxic. Right. I will use the flip of that and say it's very nice when you find people like you and other people in our lab and like Amanda in the Downey lab. I think like finding people like that who can counteract the mold and like create a safe and supportive environment, like finding those things becomes like even more, it's more nice when you find those things, because it's maybe not how it should be. I don't know if that makes sense.
Kind of like a diamond in the rough sort of situation.
Yeah.
No, it's good you mentioned about international collaboration. That was honestly the first thing I thought of. The best thing that happened in my program while in academia was traveling to an international conference and presenting work. Well, presenting work, I think, is pretty fun if you're interested in research and learning about the stuff that you do from other people. And that's where the collaboration comes in. Like you talk about or ask questions to them after their presentation and even like follow up with them. Follow them on social media, talk to them at the bar after the conference. Yeah, that whole international community could still be toxic, but again, it's just that connection and talking about stuff that you're both interested in, I found was really nice.
Yeah, I agree. I think personally, I went on exchange in my undergrad to like Stockholm, Sweden, meeting all those people there and like experiencing that. Like, I would have never been able to do that if I wasn't specifically going for like my research project that I was going for. So like those kind of opportunities are amazing. And yeah, I think like that it's something that like I'll remember forever. And like, it wasn't necessarily like all about the science, but that was the reason why I went.
Yeah, hopefully that continues to be promoted. Yeah, so that's really all the questions I had for Sarah here. So maybe we can just summarize with some final thoughts about writing, academic ghostwriting. I talked about writer's block before, academic ghostwriting even. Oh wait, that's a question I had for you. So you said that if you can't write something, you just kind of step back and just do something else. Probably what you mean by writer's block. So I was wondering, like, what are your methods of when you step back, like, what do? Do you just do something else to get over writer's block? Or
there's two things I would do. One, if I'm on a deadline and I like need to kind of take a break, but also still like finish this piece, I think I would like switch situations. I'll go like sit on my couch or something with my iPad instead and like just go through articles and like read what other people have said about the topic and like surface area read about the topic and just kind of figure out like different ways that I can approach it. Typically when I get writer's block, it's because I can't figure out how to frame the story. And that's the biggest thing for like mainstream writing is like trying to figure out what your perspective on it is going to be and like how you're going to like set the scene. And that's usually what I struggle with the most. So getting an outside perspective and like, I honestly will go to like Reddit and read like people's opinion on the topic as well, because I find that help getting like a bunch of different sides of the stories and then like trying to culminate it afterwards. If I don't have a deadline, I just like completely forget about it. I'll just go for a walk probably. Or
yeah, the walk super. The walk helps at least me for sure. All right. So again, final thoughts about writing. If people are interested in writing, like what advice you can give to them, and just, you know, you can promote yourself to the hundreds of millions of listeners that listen to this podcast.
Hey, don't sell yourself short either, Kevin.
Sure. One day.
One thing that I wanted to add was that I have never done academic ghostwriting. I don't write articles for people or don't write papers for people, but I have done content ghostwriting for websites. And I think that's like also a different like flip side of what ghostwriting could be as well. And I think like once you get into academia where like that person is benefiting off of what you are saying, then I think that's when like it becomes a bit shady and we start to think about like how we can stop that. But there are some like good sides of it as well. And like content writing is a huge one. And there's like a very large industry of people who do that and do ghostwriting. That's what I have experience in is, yeah, and you get paid to do it. The one thing that like bothered me with that sort of work was that there's not really much accountability with like the credibility of the content. So for example, like you're just expected to like write about multiple sclerosis and write it in like plain terms. I'm not a multiple sclerosis scientist, so like I don't know anything about it. So I'm literally just like trying to find the most accurate information that I can, but like they don't even make you usually put in citations or anything. So like I could literally just say whatever I wanted and it'd be taken at face value and there's no author behind it for them to be like, oh, who wrote this? It's just like this multi-billion-dollar corporation who wrote it. So it becomes more credible in that sense because it comes from this big name, but it's actually just like me in my pajamas writing about multiple sclerosis. That's like an interesting side of ghostwriting that I thought I would mention. I guess on like a final thoughts of all of this, I don't even know where to start. If you're interested in science writing though, I think that like definitely get involved with Massive Science. They have, I think it's about $15 to register for their database and you can join like their dashboard. And they also have a bunch of training to go through. So before you can write a piece, you have to go through a few different levels of training to learn how to like storytell. Yeah. And I think like kind of learning that storytelling aspect of it is huge. And it personally helped me so much with all of like my other writing that I do other than Massive. So yeah, get involved in Massive Science if you're interested in interested in writing. It's a great way to start.
It's $15 to sign up. And is it like a subscription or you just pay the $15 flat fee.
Flat fee, yeah. Their goal is to just make it as accessible as possible for everyone. Yeah, mm-hmm. So, and then, okay. So it's $15 to sign up, and then you go through the training, and then I think the first piece, you don't get paid for, because it's like a training exercise, but that piece does get published. Okay, after cool. that, you kind of go up a pay scale, so every piece you write after that, it goes up. So you'll start at like $90, and it'll go to like $120 your next article, and then I think the cap is like $160 per article, which is a pretty decent pay, to be honest.
Yeah, that's really good.
For pieces, yeah. Yeah, so that's why I love recommending them. We really need to stop perpetuating this circle of people doing things for free all the time, especially grad students. I think grad students are taken advantage of left, right, and center all the time. If you can get paid to do something, get paid to do it. Yeah, I guess other than that, I should also mention that I recently started a nonprofit called Next Generation Woman, which is also a really exciting thing that I've been doing on the side. And I'm really, really happy with the feedback that we've gotten so far. Basically, Next Generation Woman is an online career database for women and girls. And what we're trying to do is basically highlight women leaders in their fields, and by publishing different profiles of them on our website. So what that would do then is, if young girls and women are looking to either join a career or change their career, they can go to our website and look at that specific career and find women who actually do work in that field, and they can directly contact them and kind of learn more about it if they want.
That's really cool. And if people want to reach out to you, how can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter, I guess, probably the best. I don't know my handle. So you can find me on Twitter at SLAFRAMBOISE. So my last name, LaFromboise 14. But full name is Sarah LaFromboise. So you can probably just Google me and you will find me.
What's the 14?
Oh yeah, that was my hockey number growing up. So yeah.
Which is also pretty nuts that you were also into sports as well, which I shouldn't say it as a stereotypical thing, but a lot of people in science don't really do sports.
Yeah, I think like I struggled at the beginning because I was, when I started my undergrad, I was playing like full time for my first like 3 or 4 years on the women's hockey team. Both worlds didn't accept the other. You know what I mean? Like I would play hockey and everyone's like, oh, you're a scientist? Like, that's weird. And then I'd go to science class and they'd be like, oh, you play on the hockey team? That's weird.
That's weird. Which group do I belong to?
Yeah, I'm half and half, I guess. I don't even know. It's been a fun journey and know how I got here, but I'm here. I feel like that quote is my life.
That on your website?
Yeah. It's been a fun ride.
All right, well, thanks again for coming on the podcast. Best of luck in the nonprofit you started, being a part of the writing platforms where you can learn about mainstream science, the PhD project as well.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And yeah, lots of fun. I feel like we had lots to talk about. So yeah, it's been lots of fun.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the Metaforgeons podcast. As another update, by the time you're hearing this, it will be my first day as a PhD student at Trinity College, University of Dublin. Super excited to get back into research on the microbiome. I'll give you more updates again via bits and pieces throughout the season, so stay tuned and hope you enjoy this crazy journey with me. Remember to follow the Instagram page for visual updates, as well as be entered into the draw for the custom butterfly-printed Metaforgeon shirt, which will be given out on the 30th episode. Until then, stay skeptical, but curious.